chapter of Deuteronomy, and tonight we will begin the fourth chapter of Deuteronomy. In the last verse of the last chapter, verse 29, he says, "So we abode in the valley over against Beth-peor." And as we mentioned, Beth-peor is a contraction of two words, Beth meaning house and Peor meaning an idol. And so it was probably an area named after an idol worship place or idol worship house. Here they are now camped on the eastern side of the Jordan River in the plain of Moab, having conquered two nations, Heshbon and Bashan. And we have Moses this time giving the people some laws and some commandments, some reminders, statutes, and recounting some of their past history in order to prepare them to be able to take the land of Canaan and to properly serve God once they get there. So beginning with the first verse of chapter 4, "Now therefore hearken, O Israel, unto the statutes and unto the judgments which I teach you, for to do them, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers giveth you." He says to hearken, O Israel, unto the statutes and unto the judgments which I teach you. Now this word statutes, one meaning of it is a decreed limit. A decreed limit. When something has been decreed, it's been given forth as a law or as a rule. And a limit then is something that is to curtail activity some way or another. A decreed limit. We find that when we study the very nature of man, that a limit or limits is certainly one of the things that he has desperate need of in order to be happy. We say in raising a child that there are two things a child must have. The child must have love and limits. If a child does not have limits, he's going to be a very, very unhappy child. A child that doesn't know what his limitations are. If he doesn't have any borders drawn and say, now this you cannot do and that you cannot do, that's an unhappy child. That child will come into a house or a room and never find anything to be satisfied with. He'll be climbing the wall before he's over, but he still will never be happy. Whereas a child that has limits, he knows what he can and what he can't do, then he can come in and find something and occupy himself and be perfectly contented and happy because he knows he's within his limitations. But until those limits are demonstrated to a child, he will always continually be searching to see how far he can go, how much he can possibly get away with, trying to find the limits. And it's true with humans. We have to have limits. God knows this. And so he gives statutes, which are decreed limits. God gives us our limits. He tells us things that we cannot do, that we should not do, and must not do. And so we have a certain number of negatives, as well as positives, in our teaching from God. So he said, O Israel, hearken unto the statutes, or these decreed limits, and unto the judgments which I teach you. Now the word judgments here can mean several things. One of the meaning of judgments is that it is a law given by a judge. A law given by a judge. And certainly God is a judge. He does and will judge us. And so here we have the law given by the judge. Now, you know, that's a pretty high area to get a law from, because when, for example, in this society, when we get into trouble with the law, we ultimately come before some kind of a judge. Now, if the judge is the one who makes the law, then if we follow the law, then we're going to be pretty well in line with what that judge wants. And if we ever come before him, we're going to be found in favor in his eyes if we follow the law that he himself has given. And so here it is with God. God's going to be our judge, but also God gives us the law. He gives us the judgment. So if we follow the judgment that the judge gives, we certainly are doing that which is right. We can't be displeasing to him then. So I've given unto you, or he says, hearken unto the statutes and unto the judgments which I teach you for to do them. Now, it's not just a matter of hearing something and learning it and being able to expound upon it, but he says, for to do them. These are things to do, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your father giveth you. Now, the purpose of following these, the immediate purpose was so that they could live and go in and possess the land. God wanted them to have this land, but it was given on the condition that they would follow his judgments, his statutes, his teachings. And if they didn't follow them, they actually wouldn't even be qualified to possess this land. Because one of the qualifications was that they be a follower of God. And we're going to find later in this chapter that he definitely promises them that if they stop following him, that he will take this land away from them. Verse 2, ye shall not add unto the word which I command you, neither shall ye diminish aught from it, that ye may keep the commandments of the Lord your God which I command you. Now this is a very important teaching. It's one that the principle of which is repeated many times in the Bible. And it's one that if we neglect this one principle right here, then it does us no good to try to serve God, because we then have violated a basic premise of our ability to follow God. He says, you shall not add unto the word that I command you, which I command you, neither shall you diminish aught from it. That's simple. Simple for us to understand. You shall not add to it. You shall not take away from it. Leave it like it is. Don't add to it. Don't take away from it. We do not have the permission or the privilege to put in any command that God hasn't put here. Nor can we embellish it by interpreting it in such a way that is not there. Nor do we have the privilege to take away from any command. Detract from it, subtract from it, shorten it, abbreviate it. We don't have that privilege. And actually, when we do this, if we add to or take away from his commands, then we find ourselves in the position of interpreting them in the place of God. And when we have the position of interpreting them, then we become a lawgiver ourselves. Let me change a law by adding to it or by taking away from it, and I can completely change that law to suit any desire that I may have, whether it be the law of the land or the law of God. That's one of the reasons that the Supreme Court in our nation has so much power, is because they have the power to interpret the law. Let Congress or the President pass any law they want to, but when the Supreme Court gets ready to interpret it and has the privilege of interpreting it, they can make it read anything they want it to read. They have all power in that respect. And we do not have that power over God's laws. It puts us in a position that is superior to God himself for us to interpret his laws by adding to or taking away. So we must leave them like they are. We must have a thus saith the Lord for what we teach and command. We must have the authority of Christ. We're told in the New Testament that whatsoever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by him. We must do it in his name or by his authority. And so one of the basic premises here given on the banks of the Jordan River before they crossed into the land of Canaan was, do not add to and do not diminish from. That's very simple, it's very concise, but it is all-inclusive and it means so much. So let's not let anybody impose a law upon us that we can't find in the Bible. Nor let's not let anybody take a law away from us which we do find in the Bible. Now in verse 3 he says, your eyes have seen what the Lord did because of Baal-peor. For all the men that followed Baal-peor, the Lord thy God hath destroyed them from among you. Now this word Baal, B-A-A-L, is a name which means a god that was worshipped by many of the people in this part of the world. Peor is also the name of a god, and it's the name of a god that was followed by the Midianite. The Moabites. It's a Moabite deity. And so this word Baal-peor is just a word for this this Peor, or this Moabite deity, this Moabite idol, which must have been rather common in that very area, because here they were dwelling on the plains of Moab, a country that used to belong to the Moabites. And so, he says, you've seen what the Lord did because of Baal-Peor. For all the men that followed Baal-Peor, the Lord thy God hath destroyed them from among you. That is, these must have been the people who were the citizens of Heshbon and Bashan. And they were followers of this particular God, and so God destroyed them. But ye that did cleave unto the Lord your God are alive, every one of you, this day. Those of you who didn't follow this idol, you're alive to this day. Now remember, they had national warfare. There were two nations that they had warfare with, and they destroyed many, many cities. But he says, every one of you are alive this day who didn't follow this God. So the warfare they had was warfare that was a holy warfare. It was directed by God, and none of them apparently lost their lives who were faithful to God. Not the kind of war that man goes out and has here today when nations go to fight. Today, both sides lose many men. But in that type of a warfare, none of them lost their lives, those who were faithful to God. Now he begins in verse 5 again by saying, behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments. And we've already discussed what they are. Statutes are the decreed limits, and the judgments are laws given by a judge. I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, that ye should do so in the land, whether ye go to possess it. Now the basic, ultimate goal of these statutes and judgments were things to be done when they got in the land. They were to be obeyed in the land. And it's just kind of like we today, whenever we obey the gospel. We obey the gospel, and there are many, many laws connected with being a Christian. But whenever we obey the gospel, we have just started to following God's laws. We've just begun. It's not the end of things. It's the beginning of things. It's not a matter of our saying, well, we've done what God wants. Now I can kind of relax. All these laws given for Christians are then to be put into effect after you obey the gospel. That's when you start really following the laws. And so it was with them. These laws applied to them now, but they really applied when they got into the land of Canaan. That was no time to let down then. That was when they were to really be strictly held. Because God had these laws for their benefit when they were in the land of Canaan. He didn't give them to them while they were prisoners back in Egypt. He gave them for their use in the land of Canaan. So in verse 6 he says, keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Now this verse is a little hard to understand, but notice what he says. He says, this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations. All these other nations round about that are going to be looking at you and observing you, the thing that's going to make you look wise and have understanding, and the thing that's going to make you cause them to take notice, is your keeping of these statutes and judgments. Because they're going to hear all these statutes. And then they'll say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Let's look at a few things here about this. God's laws, his statutes and judgments, are laws that are far above all the laws that man ever gave. Here is a nation that has the laws of God. And all the other nations, as they look around and see these laws and see how wise they are and how great they are, they then begin to pattern some of their laws after these same laws. This basic great Ten Commandments that we're going to study about in the next chapter are laws far above any that man ever gave. And so the better that the laws of other nations become, actually, the more they become patterned after the laws of God. Here's a nation that had all of them to start with. They started with all good laws. Laws from God. And so, he says, this is your wisdom and your understanding. Now, as we stop and think about this, it becomes our wisdom and our understanding today. all the nations and all the people and all the cultures round about us, if we try to compete with them in any other area, we'll not be noted as anything great. Can we compete with the mighty minds of the scientists, the astronomers, the high mathematicians, the people who are high in physics, the people who are high in knowledge and the laws of finance and government and economics? Well, we'll never be noted for our knowledge in those areas. We get out and try to compete with them, we just become another person in the marketplace. But to be somebody who stands out separate and apart from them in a great thing will be somebody who follows after the laws of God. This is the way that you will be outstanding. It's the only hope that we have of being outstanding in anything is to follow the laws of God. We can't compete with other people on their level. We'll not be able to. They use means and methods that are beyond our ability because they have no scruples in certain areas. They can lie and they can cheat and they can steal and they can do all kinds of things, which we cannot do. So to just be a half-hearted Christian and yet try to compete with other people in the things that they're great in and be renowned for those things, we'll never do it. We'll just be a common run-of-the-mill. But to be outstanding, our wisdom and our understanding in the sight of all the others is going to come in our keeping God's statutes and God's judgments. And they'll say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great? Who hath God so nigh unto them as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And Moses is asking them to compare. What nation is there that is so great that has God so close that will have them to be able to call upon him like we do for the things that we call upon him for? These other nations don't have any God like this. They call on their idols of stock and stick and stone and they don't get anything out of it. But we have the true and the living God. No nation has this. Again, he says in verse 8, and what nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law, which I set before you this day? No other nation has a law like this. A law as righteous as this law is. And righteous meaning godlike and goodly and proper. No other nation has a law like this. And when we stop and think about it, this gives us some great appreciation for and great insight into really how great the Bible is and the laws that are in it for us. No other nation has laws like this. Laws this great and this righteous and this holy. Laws this good. Well, nations have to keep changing their laws around. They have to add things to it and take things away from it. Keep on changing the laws all the time because they're not good laws. But these basic premises of God's law are good forever. He does not have to change and revise his laws. Only take heed to thyself and keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget the things which thine eyes have seen, and lest they depart from thy heart all the days of thy life. Now, in this verse, he tells them another very, very basic thing. Take heed to thyself, keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget. It's not enough just to hear these things one time, or it's not enough to have known them well at one time. We must take every measure that we can to not allow ourselves to forget. It means not only to learn new things, but it means to also take the things that we have already learned and continually review them, reteach them, review them over and over again so that we do not forget. Now, I find in my own personal self that I can study a passage of the Bible and I can know it quite well. I can teach it in a way that I think is fairly well given a good explanation of it and yet not come back to it for a few years and I'm cold on that passage again. I have to re-study it. I have to relearn it because we forget. So there's a continual reminding that's required. And Peter said in his teaching that he made an effort so that after he departed from this life, that they would always be able to have these things in remembrance. And really, everything that we teach now is something that has already been taught, and we're simply making a remembrance of it. It's not new teaching, we're just making a remembrance of it. And so, this is one of the basic things that he says here in verse 9. Take heed to thyself, and keep thou so diligently, lest thou forget. Now notice what he says. Forget the things which thine eyes have seen. Not just something that's been taught to you, like we today have to depend on. We have to depend on something just being taught to us today. We don't actually see it and experience it with our eyes. But they had seen these things. But he says, take heed lest thine eyes forget the things that thou hast seen. Now, it's harder to forget something you've seen than it is to forget something you've just been taught in your mind. So we really have to take heed ourselves today. Lest they depart from thine heart all the days of thy life, he says, but teach them thy sons and thy sons' sons. It's not only intended for you, but you pass them on to your sons and your sons' sons. So another basic premise of the Bible is that the teaching of the Bible be passed on. Not just that you learn it and you live it and that's that. It doesn't end there. You teach it to your son and to your son's sons. And as Paul told Timothy, to take these things and commit them to other faithful men, that they may teach others also. That's God's plan. His plan is that we teach and yet that we also teach somebody else. We learn and we teach. And we pass it on so that this thing is perpetuated in man. So, the theme of verse 9 is to remember. Remember what you've already learned. Then in verse 10, he specifies now more what he has in mind. He says, especially the day that thou stoodest before the Lord thy God in Horeb. Now, this is what I want you to especially remember. This day that you stood in Horeb before the Lord thy God. Now, where is Horeb? Horeb is Mount Sinai. It's the mountain down in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula where they received the law, the Ten Commandments. Now he says, I want you to make a special remembrance of that day when you stood there and you received that law on Mount Sinai. And the bulk of the rest of this chapter now has to do with God's giving that law on Mount Sinai. In the next chapter, chapter 5, we're going to have him restating the Ten Commandments. And we'll study those when we get to that chapter. But this is a very important thing with God. He says, especially remember when you've received this law in Mount Horeb. The day that thou stoodest before the Lord thy God in Horeb. When the Lord said unto me, gather me the people together, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. So we see God stating his purpose. This is the purpose that he gave this law, that they may learn to fear me all the days upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. And ye came near and stood under the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire unto the midst of heaven with darkness, clouds, and thick darkness. And that phrase, thick darkness, is also translated by some as gloom. And we can read about this in Exodus, chapters 19 and 20. They did come to this mountain. All the whole mountain was on a smoke. There was thunderings and there was quakes and there was this darkness. And there were certain limits that the people could not cross unless they would be put to death. And some of the animals couldn't cross the boundaries. And while they were in this situation, God spoke to them. He gave them his law. Verse 12, and the Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. Now this mountain was not only just smoking, but there was a fire there. And God spoke to them out of the midst of the fire. Now God has done this several times. We remember the case of Moses when he stood before the burning bush. And he was spoken to out of the fire there. The fire that did not consume the bush. And he was told, take off thy shoes, for the ground on which you're standing is holy ground. And here again, on this Mount Horeb, God spoke out of the midst of the fire. He heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude, only he heard a voice. Now, here's something that we may not realize about the giving of the Ten Commandments. It wasn't just a matter of Moses going up on Mount Sinai and getting the two tables of stone with the Ten Commandments written on them. God spoke out of this fire on the mountain, and he gave the commandments to the people with his voice. He spoke with his voice and gave it to them. And then Moses got them written on the two tables of stone. And he says at this time that you saw no similitude. That is, you did not see any image of God. You saw nothing that would let you know what God looks like. You saw no form or image of God. You saw no similitude, only you heard a voice. Now, God did this on purpose. He would not let them see anything that they could recreate in a picture or an idol or a carved image or anything that would be called God. They saw nothing. They only heard the voice. And he declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments. And the original Hebrew here, I believe, says the 10 words. It calls the 10 commandments the 10 words. And he wrote them upon two tables of stone. These 10 commandments were written on two tables of stone. They were written on the front and on the back. And it is thought that the first four were written on one table, and the second six were written on the second table. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that you might do them in the land whether you go over to possess it. Take ye therefore good heed unto yourselves, for you saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Lord spake unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire. Now, he's giving him a very cautious warning here, because we're coming to another really important point in God's demands of his people. He says, take good heed unto yourselves, for you saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Lord spake unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest you corrupt yourselves and make you a graven image, the similitude of any figure, the likeness of male or female. Now, the reason he did not let them see any kind of a similitude of himself, any kind of a vision of himself, was so they wouldn't make any kind of a graven image, the similitude of any figure, the likeness of male or female. They were not allowed to make any kind of a similitude. Now, it's a strange thing, then, in the view of this, knowing how God feels about this, it's a strange thing, then, that we have all kinds of pictures painted today of a figure that they call the Son of God, Jesus Christ. Nobody's ever seen him that lived to paint any of those pictures. We have pictures today of those things. And we have graven images of Jesus hanging on the cross. And we have these images of a cross and of the angels and of the Virgin Mary. And of on and on and on, the apostles, all these images and these paintings and these recreations that have come out of men's minds, and God here takes extra precaution that this would not happen. He says that you should not make your graven image the similitude of any figure. Don't make anything similar to any figure, the likeness of male or female. And he goes on and expounds on this now. Verse 17, the likeness of any beast that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged fowl that flieth in the air, the likeness of anything that creepeth on the ground, the likeness of any fish that's in the waters beneath the earth. And lest thou lift up thine eyes unto heaven, and when thou seest the sun, the moon, and the stars, and even all the hosts of heaven, shouldest be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God hath divided unto all nations under the whole heaven. But the Lord hath taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt, to be unto him a people of inheritance, as you are this day. So he takes special precaution here to tell them not to make any kind of an image like him, or like any likeness to a male or a female, or the birds or the beast or the fish or the stars in heaven. None of these things can be used. And so we see that God really didn't just kind of half-heartedly, as an afterthought, say not to be guilty of idolatry. He spells it out here in no uncertain terms that they're to be unusually careful in this area. Now let's notice that verse 20 again. But the Lord hath taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt. Now here Egypt is called the iron furnace. Egypt was a trying place. It was a testing ground for God's people. We're told in Peter, beloved, think it not strange when you have the fiery trial which shall come upon you. We're going to be tried in the iron furnace too, so to speak. The fiery trial. When you think of a trial by fire, you think of a trial that has to do with testing of metals, especially precious metals like silver and gold. Egypt is called the iron furnace. Now here they were in the iron furnace. They were being tried. And this is an example of God also being a fire to try and to test and to prove and to save you from the things that can't stand the test of the fire. Even out of Egypt, to be unto you a people of inheritance as ye are this day. Furthermore, the Lord was angry with me for your sakes and sware that I should not go over Jordan and that I should not go in unto that good land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. But I must die in this land. I must not go over Jordan, but ye shall go over and possess that good land. Oh, Moses is very sensitive on this point, and he's very emphatic and plain about it. I must die on this side. I can't go over to that good land, but ye can go over to that good land, and ye can have it. Ye can possess that good land. Again in verse 23, take heed unto yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he hath made with you, and make a graven image, or the likeness of anything, which the Lord thy God hath forbidden thee. Again, he reminds them, don't forget about this law now, about the graven image, and about the likeness of anything. Don't forget that. For the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. Now, that's the phrase we have quoted again in the New Testament. Notice the two kinds of fire God is. Number one, he is a fire that's not a consuming fire. He was in the burning bush with Moses. He was on Mount Horeb with the people. And he had them over in Egypt, which he called the furnace, the iron furnace. Those fires did not consume. But he also is a consuming fire. If the occasion arises, and he needs to, he can consume, he can burn and destroy. And I would like to turn over now to Hebrews, the 12th chapter, and study that passage that makes a quotation from this passage in Deuteronomy. Hebrews 12, we'd like to begin with the 18th verse. Now notice, this subject now is about the time when they stood before Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. It's about the time when God spoke to them out of the burning mountain and he gave them a law. Paul, as he writes the book of Hebrews, has that in mind. Notice what a solemn occasion it is for God's people. It's such a solemn occasion that he says that nothing ever has happened like it before or since. I won't say since. Nothing's ever happened like it before that time. And so Paul, in writing to the Hebrews, he reminds them of this occasion, and he reminds them of their situation in the church, beginning with Hebrews 12 now, verse 18. For ye are not come unto the mount that might be touched, and that burned with fire, neither unto blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet, and the voice of words, which voice they that heard entreated that the word should not be spoken unto them any more. Paul is recounting what we read about tonight in Deuteronomy and also what Exodus teaches in Exodus 19 and 20. He says, you haven't come to that mountain. And we haven't. We haven't come to Mount Sinai. We haven't seen the blackness and the darkness and the thunderings and heard this voice which spoke, the voice that was so terrible that those who heard it begged that it not be spoken to them anymore. For they could not endure that which was commanded. And if so much as a beast touched the mountain, it shall be stoned or thrust through with a dart. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. And we might note that this quotation here is not found in the Old Testament, but it must have been given by the Spirit who gave them an additional
area of truth.
Even Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. Oh, this must have been a terrible sight. But Paul says, you haven't come to that. What have we come to then? But ye are come unto Mount Zion. Not Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. You're come unto Mount Zion, which is actually heaven itself, or the heavenly city. And unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. And to an innumerable company of angels. Look what we've come to. Not that mountain that was black and that smoked and that quaked and that this voice spoke from, but we've come into the Mount Zion. We've come into the heavenly Jerusalem. We've come into the city of the living God. We've come into the company of an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and the church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven. The company we're keeping is high company. The names of those there are written in heaven, he says. And to God, the judge of all. We're still in the presence of God. Although we're not at Mount Horeb, we've come in the presence of God, the judge of all. And to the spirits of just men made perfect. Even those who, those spirits of the just men made perfect. We've come to there in the presence of those spirits. And to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant. And to the blood of sprinkling. That would be the blood of Jesus. That speaketh better things than that of Abel. Now, you know, Abel offered a sacrifice that was more acceptable than Cain's sacrifice. But his sacrifice didn't speak near as good of things as the blood we've come to. Speaketh better things than that of Abel. See that you refuse not him that speaketh. Now you see how Moses was talking about it? He says, be sure you don't forget. Do not forget what he said. Now Paul is saying to this God that we hear, he says, see that you refuse not him that speaketh. For if they escape not who refuse not that spake on earth, much more shall not we escape if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven. Oh, at that time he spoke from earth. He spoke from Mount Horeb. Today he speaks from heaven. And so we surely won't be allowed to escape if we neglect him that speaketh from heaven. Whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. Then he shook the earth. But now there's coming a time when he's going to shake once more, not only the earth, but also heaven. And Paul explains by saying, and this word yet once more signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. There's coming a time when all the things that are made, all the things that can be shaken, are going to be shaken and removed, so that only the things that remain are going to be the things that which cannot be shaken. Only the things which cannot be shaken will remain. And so he says, wherefore we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved. Now, what's not going to be moved? What cannot be shaken? This kingdom that we've received. We receive the kingdom which cannot be moved, he says. Let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. The quotation from Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 4:24, which we're studying tonight. So you see how Paul had this same passage in mind that Moses is saying. He reiterates many of the things that Moses has said about Mount Sinai and Mount Horeb and God speaking there. But he also tells about our position as Christians today, how we truly then are going through a type of the same thing that they went through then, except the God now is speaking from heaven, and our punishment is more sore because when he shakes today, those things that cannot be shaken are going to be destroyed and removed. And only that which cannot be moved, which is the kingdom of heaven, will remain. And he says, for our God is a consuming fire. Meaning that God is going to destroy with fire. Not just burn and not consume, but he will destroy with fire and consume with fire. So I thought that was interesting to note then, that quotation. As we read through Hebrews and just lightly read over that quotation, we don't get the picture as great as we do when we come back to Deuteronomy and get the basis for all of this. What Paul knew all of this when he made that quotation, and we can't get the meaning of it if we don't also know what Moses said. So he says, for the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. And this phrase, jealous God, means that he's a God who's afraid that you're going to replace him with another God. And he doesn't want that. So in verse 25 he says, when thou shalt beget children, and children's children, and ye shall have remained long in the land, and shall corrupt yourselves,
and make a graven image or the likeness of anything, and shall do evil in the sight of the Lord thy God to provoke him to anger. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that ye shall soon utterly perish from off the land wherein ye go over Jordan to possess it. Ye shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. Now Moses is saying here that if you go over into this land, and you, your children, or your children's children, violate this rule about making the graven image, or about making the likeness of anything that God forbids you to do, you violate this, and you make God angry, you're going to be destroyed. You shall not prolong your days upon this land, but you shall be utterly destroyed. And the Revised Standard Version says, in the place of being utterly destroyed, it says you shall be wiped out. Now, if we were standing back there on the banks of the Jordan River at Beth Peor and hearing Moses say this, I am sure we could not get as much of an impact out of it as we can today, standing where we are now, this side of the cross, and looking back and seeing what this people actually did have happen to them. They actually did have this very thing happen to them. They made these idols. They made these images that God commanded them not to make. They did incur God's wrath. God gave them every chance to repent. They didn't do it. It was their children's children that did it, and they were wiped out, so to speak, in that they were completely carried off of the land and disinherited, and the land was made then a desolate place. And he goes on with the prophecy now, verse 27. And the Lord shall scatter you among the nations, and ye shall be left few in number among the heathen, whither the Lord shall lead you. This certainly was true. They were scattered among the nations. And they've been a scattered people in many regards from that time to this time. You shall be left few in number among the heathen, whither the Lord shall lead you. The Jewish people have been a hated and a despised people. They have always been in the minority, yet they have been scattered among all nations. Historians and sociologists tell us that the Jewish culture is found everywhere. Japan, China, Africa, just about any place you can name. The Jewish culture is there. They've been scattered to all these places. And I might mention one thing here in passing. He told about how great this law was that he gave them, and how that no other nation had it. Had this scattering happened to any other nation, they would have been completely annihilated from the face of the earth as a people and as a culture. But this culture of the Jewish nation is so great and so powerful, until regardless of where they are taken or how few a number they are, it keeps cropping up. They may remain intact as the Israelite people. They remain intact because they have a culture that is so strong. It is so self-supporting. It is so buoyant among all the other cultures of the world until it survives because it came from God. No other culture can do that, but this culture does. We don't know of any other culture as surviving as this one is. They're small in number. They're few everywhere they are, but still the culture is there. And he goes on in verse 28 and says, and there you shall serve gods, the work of men's hands,